Hey folks, welcome to another episode of Long Shots. Hey Sharad, how's it going, man?
It's going very well. And whenever there's someone on the investing side of things, I get super excited. So I'm excited as always today.
Yeah, so we had Vivek Mashrani last week. And obviously with him, things were more, I would say, knowledge, quote unquote, education centric. Yeah. He was very particular about it, that these are not recommendations. He kind of almost inserted the disclaimer from his end while we forgot to do our job. But today, I don't think that should be a problem. Today, we have an active market participant with us, Harsh Tolani. Hey, Harsh, how's it going, man?
I'm good. How are you guys?
All good. No, thanks a lot for finding the time. Harsh, I'll just give a bit of an intro, runs a boutique investment fund for quote-unquote ultra-high net worth families. And he is definitely a proponent of deep value investing based on the kind of things he says, he talks about. He generally is always on the lookout for deeply discounted opportunities within the Indian markets. And he also runs Investing Hub, the platform which posts a lot of video content at recurring basis, giving actionable stock picks. Obviously, Harsh, I think you can be much more eloquent about what you guys are doing at Investing Hub. So maybe we can start with that before, you know, kind of taking this conversation forward.
Sure. Thank you so much, Nikhil. So investinghub.in is a video platform where we get some of India's finest fund managers, heads of research and analysts to talk about their favorite stock idea. We ask each person, what's the number one stock you're most bullish about? What's the highest conviction investment idea which you have? And everybody can present on just one company. And then we shoot a 20 to 40 minute long presentation where they talk about the industry, the product, the financials of the company, what metrics you should monitor, what the management is like, and the risks and concerns. And we had a very cheap proposition, just 350 rupees a month. Every 2 weeks, you get a brand new stock idea.
Right. It's a kind of actionable oriented product. Yes. Right, which kind of is interesting because, you know, obviously there's a lot of gyan available online, but it's always more fascinating when a practitioner presents a high conviction idea. And I mean, you might agree or disagree with the idea itself, but just the fact that someone actually breaks it down in a fair amount of detail, I think gives a lot of color to your potential viewers.
That's true. There's so much noise out there. Because right now, however, a typical person invests, he hears something, he sees something in an elevator, his neighbor gives him a stock idea. Or when he's reading articles or watching a channel, someone says that India inflation is 7% or unemployment rate is, say, 5.5%. He's like, what do I do with this information?
Yeah.
You know, every day on Twitter, I mean, just by spending like 15, 20 minutes a day, I think I can get like 5 stock picks every day. I mean, that's become, Harsh, like interesting business proposition, right? But a question that I have is like, you know, typically access to sell side research analysts or fund managers or head of researchers is sort of paywall generally, right? It's institutional in nature. And this is obviously open to more of a retail audience, right? How does the model work when the access to such thought leadership typically is associated with paywall? And is that, how do you structure a business around it?
No, so we are behind a paywall where we charge 350 rupees a month.
Got it.
But yes, we don't charge lakhs the way a sell-side research does.
Sure.
And we typically reach out to various medium-sized or smaller-sized PMS guys.
Yeah.
Who are more open to sharing their ideas because they would also, you know, want their ideas to be out there.
Yeah. So, you know,
and
I mean,
essentially more companies in the mid-cap space, mid-cap and small-cap space, which don't have that much institutional coverage.
That's excellent. I mean, there's so many names out there in the Indian ecosystem which just fly under the radar all the time, yeah.
But, you know, I mean, and I guess that kind of sits in well with your kind of deep value approach, right? I mean, you don't look at very well-covered companies. I mean, I just kind of was browsing through Investing Hub's website and I was just seeing the names of a few companies that you guys have been, you know, presenting on over the last couple of weeks.
Sure.
I mean, these are not names that you see daily in on a Business Standard or a Live Mint, right? These are fairly niche, mid-market or small pack or small cap opportunities.
In fact, with me as an investor also, my edge is my size. Like somebody might be covering, say, Tata Motors over the last, say, 15 years or Infosys or anything. I have no special insight compared to somebody who's been like tracking the company so much in depth. Say the Maruti analyst will know every single model of Maruti, the size of a tire, the dicky capacity, the length of the card up to a centimeter. And usually only the top 100 to 150 stocks are covered by analysts out of the thousands of companies in India. And there's an entire ocean of companies which absolutely nobody's looking at. It might be due to size issues, liquidity issues. It's very different, you know, when you're running a 50,000 crore company versus, you know, managing like 30 to 40 crores or even like a small-time retail investor.
Yeah. But, you know, how do you square that with normal concerns which people have with like mid caps and small caps, you know, in terms of information asymmetry, in terms of just disclosures not being that good, management access? How do you kind of try to plug that gap? Or do you think that really is a bit of an overstated idea to start with? And there are actually high quality plays that you can find with good disclosures within the small cap and the mid cap universe.
Very valid concerns. And yes, it's difficult to meet management. Often the promoters don't want to talk about their companies. They don't have quarterly con calls, which is absolutely true. But there is also a quote is that my diligence is the price. At least when I personally invest, I buy companies which are so incredibly cheap. Maybe not 2x earnings, 3x earnings, when all the bad news is already priced in.
Right. So, I mean, so the idea here is more that you look at severely undervalued opportunities where everything is priced in, like you said, or there is also an added layer of, you know, things like doing channel checks, not just depending on desktop research, actually going at the ground level to verify, you know, what a lot of these companies are communicating to the shareholder community. I mean, is that also a part of your philosophy? Or it's more that, look, there's so much margin of safety already considering the price at which this is trading, that even if we are wrong, we can't be so wrong. I mean, for the lack of a better way of explaining this.
Yeah, that's exactly what I do, actually. Everybody has their own different investing style. And my personal thing is that just go for incredible prices and you should be covered in terms of margin of safety. And it's often very hard to do channel checks for the smaller companies.
And sort of is, you know, valuation and pricing your the go-to metric in terms of how you look at a stock, or other factors that you factor in? What, you know, if someone were to ask you for investment philosophy or something that you look for personally, where would you lean towards, you know, valuation-centric, value picks?
All right. So there are multiple ways to make money. My personal investing style is deep value investing, where I buy an asset worth 100 rupees for 40 rupees. And I get out when it reaches 60 rupees. I don't wait for it to even reach 80 or 90 rupees.
Got it. So there's a margin of safety priority.
Yeah. So in India, actually, it's a growing market. And everybody typically looks at growth companies. Companies with high ROE, they have a fairly high growth trajectory. But most of these companies are very expensive right now. And I am basically fishing in a pond where nobody else is fishing. Which is when I buy a company, say at 3x earnings, I sell it when it has a 5x earnings. That's a 60% increase. Or I go, say, from 4x earnings to 6x earnings. That's a 50%. And I've actually back-tested all this, these techniques, and I've seen that it works. Whatever methods that I use is not something which, you know, I've created myself. This has been used by Benjamin Graham. It's used by Warren Buffett the first 30 years of his career. People only look at the modern Buffett. But the first 30 years of his career, he was a deep value guy, you know, buying companies at low price to book, low EV by a bit, low P by E. And this has been shown to work in other countries, across geographies, across time periods. And I've adapted it to India. And what I did, I've spent a couple of years actually just backtesting this. Does it actually work in India? So you pull out all the data from Capital Line. You know, you copy paste into Excel and you do like various data manipulation. And I have found that this tends to beat the index by around 10% or so.
Right.
When you say index, you mean the relevant index it's part of, or do you mean like benchmark, the Nifty headline index?
I mean the BSE 500.
Okay.
Yeah. Well, I mean, you kind of have a long background in the formalized banking world also. You were at Standard Chartered for, I think, a little over 4 or 5 years.
Yeah.
And obviously, you know, working in a big... I would say a multinational setup where, you know, processes and structures have been laid out for years, then moving into a framework where, you know, you kind of had to set your own framework to start with.
Sure.
Right. And within that, you've kind of obviously, you know, looked at deep value investing in a fairly methodical manner. But today we are going to also, you know, talk a bit about something which is not talked about a lot, I think, within the Indian markets context, right? Looking at things from a more quote-unquote quantitative perspective. We have kind of, you know, briefly spoken about that offline before the podcast in terms of, you know, how you look at factor-based investing. Frankly, you know, that those two, three words, I recall something in B school about it, you know, then Sharad revived my memory. He was saying, you know, you remember that Pharma French three-factor model? It's about that. Yeah. I'm like, oh, okay. So, I mean, I obviously would like to be educated about that myself. I think a fair amount of updation is required since we were, you know, studying ourselves. So you kind of look at factor-based investing pretty closely. What is it?
So basically, I'll start with quantitative investing. Quantitative investing is anything where you use mathematical models to make decisions on your behalf. It can involve arbitrage trading. It can involve high-frequency trading. That's not what I do. What I do is often called factor-based investing, where I use certain factors involving value, which might be EV by bit, PE ratio, PEG ratio, price per book. It involves quality factors like return on capital, ROC, the Petrovsky F-score. That's to filter out all the junk companies. You can set filters to avoid frauds.
Okay. Oh, interesting.
And you can also look at price momentum also. So that's what I do. And this has been shown in other markets as well as India to do really, really well. Unfortunately, in India, it's not talked about as much because data wasn't available. In India, reliable data is available only from 2005 onwards. Because before that, we had physical trading. A lot of companies weren't traded on a daily basis and the price isn't very reliable because everything is paper and nobody has bothered to digitize it. In the US, they have price data going all the way back up to 1920s. You have certain research institutes which have actually digitized everything.
Yeah, Harsh, you know, like it's interesting your approach to factor investing, and very exciting as well. You know, that, like you yourself named so many different factors, and like, you know, there are other factors, volatility and dividend yields and valuation.
Sure.
Like, how do you prioritize or, you know, bring those home together in a model? Like, you know, in a small cap world, typically you won't associate dividend yields, right? I mean, generally, you rarely see it. You see it in the... So when there are so many different factors and some go in line, some go offline, like how do you prioritize and bring it together? Is that entirely just mathematically formula-based assigning different weights, or how do you... Like, is it more art than science, would you argue?
It is a science, but actually, no matter what factor you choose, whether you look at, say, EBIT, you look at EBITDA, you look at operating cash flow, you look at free cash flow, you look at profit after tax, no matter what you look at, it's important that you stick to a particular factor or the formula.
Yeah.
Because it goes through long periods of underperformance. Don't keep jumping between things.
Got it. Yeah.
No matter what you use, you will beat the index. Some will beat it maybe by 3%, something will beat by 7%, but stick to it. Sticking to it is the hardest thing possible. As far as what I do, I primarily use first value factors.
Yeah.
On top of that, first I get the cheap companies, then I remove the low quality companies, I'm buying high quality companies, and then you can put an overlay of momentum on top. The point of putting momentum is, instead of buying, say, the number one cheapest company in India or the number two cheapest company, you might be buying, say, the 21st cheapest company in India, which at one point in time was the second or third cheapest company. Because often what happens is you buy a supremely undervalued company and it tends to become a value trap. The price does nothing for 3 to 5 years. It's a very painful period where you start questioning yourself. And the day you sell, the price goes up 4 times in 6 months. Often you might be missing out in the first, say, 15 to 20% of the price movement, but you're catching the rest of the price movement. You avoid the price being flat for a long period of time by adding momentum to this.
So you have kind of prioritized the factors, right? I mean, it kind of sounds like you're using the factors kind of as a screening or
exactly.
Shortlisting. Layer to the
right.
So you kind of take the cheap, you have taken the stuff which is not trading at a premium, which is cheap, then you filter out the stuff which is fundamentally not doing well, and you kind of have a relatively small pool of companies which are undervalued but which have solid fundamentals, which don't have any red flags. Correct.
Exactly.
And then on top of that, you kind of put a momentum filter to see in which direction they have been trading in recent times to make sure that you can time it.
Exactly.
Isn't it, I mean, is there a sectoral layer also which gets added to it, in the sense that, I mean, when you were like talking about value multiples, I mean, I'm kind of, my question has a bit of bias because I used to cover banks, right? I used to cover banks and financial institutions. And in the case of banks, like, you don't look at an EV EBITDA. You don't even look at price earnings. Like, you look at price to book. Or in case, say, in an insurance company, you look at price to embedded value. So do you do those kind of, I mean, utility companies have some specific ratios that you look at, right? So do you also like add that sectoral layer on top?
So to be honest, I discard all the financial companies. And that's what most quant investors do.
Okay.
That's because banks often have very opaque balance sheets, as you might know. It's hard to tell what the quality of the assets are underlying. On paper, everything may seem rosy and seem very good, but you don't know what's actually underneath. And, you know, I've worked for a bank before and I've seen it firsthand also. The way things can be evergreen, they can be rolled over, there's plenty of ways to do things.
Yeah. You know, Harsh, your take on factor investing. Are there some of the big institutes or banks or, you know, investment houses who are sort of following a methodical factor-based investing approach today in India?
So in India, there aren't, I'm not really aware of anything, but in the US, the world's second biggest fund, AQR Capital Applied Quantitative Research, they have been doing it. And regularly, they come out with really outstanding research. In fact, the way AQR was started in 1990, their founder, Clifford Esnes, he was doing his PhD at that time, and he found an anomaly while digging through the data on the momentum. And one of his mentors in the PhD program was the Nobel Prize winner who had won for the efficient market hypothesis.
Got it.
Speculating is Eugene Farmer and friends. I'm not sure.
Yeah.
I think it's them. And he actually, you know, went to his mentor, his PhD guide, with his tail between his legs. Listen, I found this anomaly. Does it actually work? He said that, listen, you test it out. If it works then. And he actually found that momentum works. And that's how he joined Goldman Sachs, set up a quant team in Goldman Sachs. These guys were making so much money that the team eventually quit to form AQR, Applied Quantitative Research. And now with $300 billion assets under management, they're the world's second biggest hedge fund.
I mean, there are two parts to it, right? One is obviously the screens or the filters to shortlist.
Sure.
And the other is the timing of execution. And there is automation possible in both, in the sense that you obviously have, like, you know, quant firms who have automated the execution end of things as well. Like, there's no one who's going to look at a screen and look at the shortlist and put some sort of a qualitative measure. I mean, if something satisfies through the filter at that right time, they're just going to execute the trade.
Yeah.
Do you kind of stretch things all the way till the end, as of now, within your fund? Or you still put a qualitative kind of a hat in the end and time it manually? Because I often feel there's no right answer to this, you know? I mean, it kind of, you know, I think the truth is somewhere in between. And there are success stories across both sides of the spectrum.
So from my shortlist, I do go to the annual report. I do go and see what product are they manufacturing. I do see if the numbers are right, because occasionally the database, it's possible the numbers might be wrong on the database, or there might be some accounting thing. But more or less, I don't try and reject names too much. And with every quant investor, including Joel Greenblatt, one of the world's greatest investors, a billionaire himself, yes, sir. Every time he's tried to use his own subjective knowledge on top of that, every time he's used his own judgment, he's underperformed it. Because often the companies which show up, they are so cheap because there's bad news around the stock. And you wouldn't want to touch the company sometimes with a barge pole, for example, for various reasons. It might be a cyclical industry which is showing up. Like, you may think that, oh, right now, say the sugar industry wasn't doing well, or the steel industry, or, you know, the paper industry. Or sometimes the company might be going through certain regulatory changes, but all that is priced in.
But that's like one of the oldest debates in markets also, right? I mean, this is like typical efficient market hypothesis, that the market is actually pricing it all in. There is kind of a counter argument as well that, like, for instance, I mean, only recently we were, I think we chanced upon this interesting blog by Damodaran, which we also, I think, spoke about briefly with Vivek. Where, you know, Damodaran kind of wrote a critique on value investing. And he said that why value investing is losing relevance in the modern world. And he was kind of, you know, trying to give an argument being a devil's advocate in that. And one of the points which I think was pretty interesting was that he was saying that accounting, like companies' accounting regimes themselves have over time become quite aggressive. That there are actually, and we all come from investment banking background. We ourselves know how bankers themselves put so much emphasis on, you know, adjusted EBITDA numbers or, you know, doing all sorts of, I would say, monkey business when it comes to reporting numbers, at least in presentations, maybe not in the actual audited accounts, but in the presentations, which a lot of investors look at. So, I mean, that was a big critical point that Damodaran made, that, you know, because of that, those kinds of, for the lack of the better word, factors, that purely looking at, an automated quantitative philosophy, assuming that the market is pricing everything in, might not be always the most effective way to go about things. And especially like within Indian markets, it's also quite funny because in Indian markets, like there are always, you know, there's always that entire, you know, narrative that there is a lot of insider trading that goes on here. And, you know, you often hear of these, I would say, incognito WhatsApp groups in several cities of the country, you know, where people are giving stock picks, they're dumping shares, and, you know, you actually see daily volatilities, which are, you know, kind of flowing as a result. How do you kind of, you know, square all of that noise with this very process-oriented, hands-off, automated approach?
Sorry, you made 3 to 4 different points, so I'm not sure if I get to...
I ramble on, sorry. you can pick anyone that you think is worth answering.
So from an academic perspective, traditionally value investing has been considered purely price by book, which was originally espoused by Graham in his book Security Analysis, later an Intelligent Investor. At that time, the financials of a company would only be the balance sheet. The P&L would not get published only, which is why he only looked at the balance sheet side of things, not the earnings side. Secondly, why price by book is not a great factor is because in 1930s, 40s, 50s, most of the companies were all manufacturing companies selling primarily commodity products. So your return on equity was mota moti almost the same for all companies. With the world changed, IT is such a huge factor. You need patents, pharma companies, the programming companies, which is why the book value is not as relevant. And out of all the value factors which you can use, price by book is actually the worst performing. So often when people say that value investing isn't as strong as it used to be, they're referring to price by book.
Yeah.
So no practitioner only uses price by book anymore.
Right.
Secondly, in the last 8 to 10 years, deep value investing hasn't worked as well. And one of the reasons is because low interest rate environments favor growth stocks, because their future earnings are now discounted less, while value stocks derive their value from immediate earnings. I think you might get some more clarity if you think of a discounted cash flow model. The growth stocks get most of their valuation from the later years. So if you use a lower discount rate, you get higher earnings, while value stocks tend to be preferred if you use a higher discounted rate. So right now we're in a low interest, low inflation environment. And, you know, so there's a negative relationship between the value premium and money supply.
Correct.
You know, following an increase in the money supply, stock price increase.
That's interesting. But Harsh, like when you look at it from such a mathematical lens, right? There's often these behavioral biases that creep in, and how do you sort of address that? And you know, I understand that when you have a very mathematical approach, you can somewhat limit it, but you still need a selling discipline. You still can't be, you know, I often joke around that, you know, herd mentality can be a proxy for momentum also. It's adding a, you can put a negative spin on the same thing. How do you go about factoring that in?
No, so in fact, the mathematical models, they protect you from making wrong decisions.
Sure, yeah.
Because you can have a very strong self-discipline in terms of rules. You can have every time a company leaves your screen, you sell it off, no matter what.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So if a company is really cheap, or you find an even cheaper company, you cycle out of that. Or you could have a very fixed holding period. I'll hold this company only for 1 year. At the end of the 1 year, I'll compulsively sell it, and I will rerun my screen.
Are you a sort of, in, you know, if young investors, and even us actually, if people ask you like, yeah, Harsha, tell me how, you know, buying principle, I can understand you've got a very neat method of doing it, and you know, you use your intelligence and basic math and formalization to get it. But how do you decide when to sell? Is it entirely like, you know, in the beginning you talked about if something you're getting for 40, which is worth 100, you'll sell it at 60. You won't wait for it to be 100. Is that sort of the way to look at it? Like, wait for a, let's say, 20% return, irrespective of what it is, you get out of it? Or is it more like, you know, if its fair value is this, I'm going to wait for it to be 20, you know, 80% of that fair value. Let's call it 20% discount, and I'll sell it. How do you go about, you know, formalizing that and coming with a rules-based approach to it?
So when you do deep value investing, you're probably never going to have a multi-bagger.
Yeah.
You usually get like a 30-40% pop when you get out.
Yeah.
Like, the most painful thing is when you watch a company go up and then it comes back, it comes down back again to where you started.
Yeah.
It's often a very painful process.
Hmm.
So, yep, I mean, I personally, I have been waiting till fair value. But a more ideal, a more theoretically sound way is to either have a fixed selling speed either over an year or as soon as it leaves your screen, you can get out.
Yeah. You know, another interesting thing, Harsh, is, you know, I'm sort of going sideways here, but when people often talk about fair value, and I've read The Intelligent Investor as well a couple of times, right?
Sure.
And so many other material out there on different investment. People often, you know, I saw that in my career as well in sell side research, is when people look at fair value, people often give it way too much of importance on their method of calculating fair value. I would, you know, fair value itself is such a artistic concept, right? I mean, the ability to forecast earnings, the ability to, in fact, even get the right discount rate, put a long-term growth rate. There are so many variables which are artistic. And when you put a layer of math around it, right? So I argue, but your inputs itself are estimates, right? I mean, no model is telling
you. No, my inputs are all historical.
All historical. So if a company's grown 5% last 5 years, CAGR, let's say you'll project, you'll use that same, or will you say, like, you know what, the better management, better macroeconomic environment, so you know what, it should be more than 5. Is that how you sort of thematically go about it?
No, that requires judgment. We don't use any judgment.
Oh, interesting.
So I personally feel, and this is my personal opinion, that growth is often overrated, and people often mistake a cyclical growth with secular growth. A lot of companies which we think are, they're facing this demographic change, it's actually they're going to revert to the mean sooner or later. So we don't project growth at all.
So you kind of look at a completely historical perspective.
And what we do, we don't just look back 1 or 2 years, we go back 7 to 8 years. We take 8 years of operating profit, 8 years of free cash flow. So we take the average operating profit over 8 years. Now whether I take 7 years, 6 years, 9 years, you still get good results. The actual number doesn't matter whether you take what years. You take a long enough time period of operating cash flow, the average. You take the average of the free cash flow, and you take the average of both of these figures to get a blended profit. So this also avoids the concept, what you said, of aggressive accounting, because eventually this shows up in the cash flows, because the cash flows are real. The cash is real. And if you take it over a 7 to 8 year time period, it all evens out.
And you also are taking into account track record, right? You're kind of taking into account management capability by proxy, in a way, like kind of taking a quantitative spin at it. But you know, I mean, it's India is a strange market, you know, because in India, one can often see even large cap companies have big movements, you know. I mean, like in the US markets, if suppose like a large cap company gets like a 4 or 5% intraday movement, it's a very big story. Here it happens more frequently than that. Why do you kind of exclude large caps also? You know, like you kind of don't. I mean, I get it from the perspective of what value you add to your clients. I understand that business logic. But I mean, from a personal investment philosophy, would you be excluding them as well? Because they are a lot of these, I would say points regarding a track record, regarding historically strong performance, historically strong cash flow accrual, they naturally are getting looked at.
Yes, I have no issue against large cap companies as such. It's just that my criteria is so strict in terms of valuation and other things, that usually they don't show up on my
screens,
the large cap companies.
Right. Because you put value as a preference, right? You kind of put value as your first filter.
Value is my first filter. It's very rare for a company to fulfill these strict criteria.
You know, Harsh, you were talking about that you've tested historical data and your philosophy as well. Are there any insights that jump out of it which are amusing or interesting, which, you know, came directly from your backtesting methods?
So one thing I was quite shocked at how well this actually does. This gives you, like, from a 2012 to 2017 period during the bull market at that time, a simple screen like EV by EBIT gave returns of 35% CAGR. Like, your money would have gone up 4.5 times over that 5-year period if you just use a simple EV by EBIT screen. In fact, the screen is so powerful, there was a researcher, he looked at a 30-year period from 1981 to 2010, and he looked at across markets. He looked at, I think, 40 or 60 different countries. And in India, from 1981 till 2010, over this 30-year period, you'd have got returns of 26% CAGR just by using EV by EBITDA. Your 1 rupee would have become 858 rupees during this time period.
You know, Sharad asked in between, any guys in India who are doing this, and you said that no one in particular comes to mind, and then we went, obviously, kind of took the example of a US hedge fund. Why do you think more guys are not doing this? I mean, so is there any reason why big institutions kind of get blindsided? In your view?
Okay, so there's a couple of reasons for it. Number one, that India data wasn't available before 2005 or so. Anybody who was 4 to 5 years elder than me, okay, didn't have this data available and is not that familiar with numbers as well as I am, like Excel. After a certain age, you know, once you're in your 40s, early 50s, you can't do this kind of heavy Excel work. At the same time, people who are 4 to 5 years younger than me, they're still in their jobs working analyst positions or other things, and they don't have the spare time. But as far as bigger institutions not being able to replicate this, not because of a lack of intellect, but because of the incentive structure. It is hard to have a long-term view when you are being judged on a quarterly basis. Now, fund managers, they are paid a bonus on the basis of short-term performance and are penalized for deviating from the index. The cost of, you know, temporary underperformance is losing your job and the mutual fund losing a significant portion of customers. As a result, most mutual funds, they aren't trying to beat the index by 8 to 10%. They're just trying to track it. And furthermore, most fund managers, they can't think in terms of 5 to 7 years while making an investment because they are salaried employees and they're not even sure if they'll be working in the same institution 18 months from now.
So, like, when you look at things, like in your own experiences so far, what has been the longest period where, you know, you kind of had a position and, you know, it was underperforming the index, it was underperforming on all big institutional KPIs, so as to say, which a fund manager looks at.
So in India right now, value investing has been performing quite badly from 2018 onwards, from 2018 till today, and across the world it's been underperforming since almost 8 to 10 years. Usually, I mean, we can kind of predict mathematically looking at, you know, 60, 70 years of data plus in so many other countries. On average, you will beat the market 2/3 of a time in a given year. Over a 3-year period, that means you underperform 1 out of 3 years. See, 1 out of 3 years over a 1-year period. If you take a 3-year rolling period, you tend to beat the market 75% of the time. For a 5-year period, you beat the market 90% of the time, but there's still 1 out of 5 years where you lag the market for 5 consecutive years. And Warren Buffett has done this many times.
No, so, but I'm asking, like, in your own personal case, like, was there any particular company which you picked based on factor investing methodology? And, you know, you mentioned yourself that there are times when, like, for a long duration, you're not seeing any gains on that particular position. And you waited it out and then you ultimately actually saw a good, healthy exit op. Like, was there any particular stock which was kind of not being appreciated by the wider market over a long period of time?
So we look at things from a portfolio basis, not from an individual company basis. And yeah, I mean, there are a lot of companies, they do nothing for 3 to 5 years, suddenly they go up. There are long periods of time where this doesn't work, years and years, which is why that the reason these techniques work is because they don't work every single year. If they worked every single year, they wouldn't work. So you need to be able to willing to take the pain, you know, 3 years, 5 years. If your luck is really, really bad, maybe even up to 10 years where you underperform. But on the whole, statistically speaking, probabilistically, you should be able to beat the index. In India, if you use a pure momentum factor, and which, like, shocked me when I saw this, because I come from the value investing school where we don't look at momentum at all. Momentum screens have been giving returns of 24% CAGR. This I'm talking about from 1st January 2005 till 31st December 2019. 24% CAGR, while a typical mutual fund giving that 9%, 10%, while a value investing screen gives you around 90 to 20%. In fact, momentum has been doing so well, a lot of people from the deep value school, they become momentum investors purely by seeing how well momentum does.
That's fascinating. And in your investment philosophy, is there any room for shorting for taking short positions, either directionally or even as a hedge? Is that something that you do?
So when you look at the results, clearly you can see that the best decile, the best 10% of companies give you great returns. The worst decile give you negative returns. And you can see a complete monotonic relationship where the first decile does the best, second decile does second best, third decile does the third best. So yes, while looking at it, usually people think, why don't we go long the best decile and short the worst decile, the worst 10%. But the issue is that you do have time periods, which can be a painful 1.5, 2 years, 3 years, where the bottom 10%, in fact, outperforms the cheapest companies. As John Maynard Keynes said, the markets can be irrational longer and an investor can be solvent. But there are ways to do this. So when we look at various factors, some of them, especially value and momentum, they tend to be negatively correlated. So when value does badly, momentum does well. When momentum does badly, value tends to do well. So what you can do is, for example, go long the cheapest companies by value and short the companies whose price is falling down. Or alternatively, you go long the companies which are showing positive momentum, whose price is increasing, and you short the expensive companies. But I don't do this.
Yeah.
Yeah, no, I noticed on your on your LinkedIn profile also, you had explicitly mentioned that your returns have been excluding the use of any, derivatives. Minimal leverage. So I kind of now understand, where that's coming from. Any interesting, because I kind of advertised in the beginning that you are a practitioner, we have to see a few names. We have to look at a few companies, any interesting stuff that you've been looking at recently?
I love Ceylon Exploration. I even have a YouTube video based on it. It's an oil explorer and right now selling less than cash. The market cap is some 155 crores. They're sitting on cash of 170 crores. They're generating cash faster than they can give it back. The company has been doing amazing dividends, cash buybacks. It's just a cash generating machine. But for some reason, people don't like oil companies. And earlier it was a 300 crore market cap. The price has come down a bit. But in general, it's too cheap right now for institutions to look at. Like to LinkedIn, I added a few oil and gas analysts, the sell side guys, buy side guys. And I asked them, why don't you look at this company? And they said, listen, we love this company, but it's too cheap for our fund to be interested in it. Or our clients to say, not too cheap, too small in terms of size. But it's a great buying opportunity for people like us. There is steel companies, the Jindal Steel Hisar, the Kalyani Steel. There is the sugar companies right now are looking quite nice. Like, for example, there's Dwarike Sugar. The market cap is 240 crores. The Dwarike Sugar, Avad Sugar, the sugar companies are looking like... There's Kitex Garments, Vardhaman Acrylic.
Right.
Yeah. These
right.
are all companies Vardhaman, which you haven't heard of. I take great pride in it. That I invest in companies which nobody looks at.
Yeah. And these are sort of, not entirely, but these sort of fall into your model of investing in terms of how much discount they're currently trading at and, sustainable cash flow or operating profit over the, decent track record. Is that sort of, they pass that test right now or is still... yet to do a deep dive?
No, all these pass the tests. I personally invest in these companies.
Okay.
Like, for example, say Saurashtra Cement. Cement is a commodity industry. But each cement company has a monopoly over a particular area they look at. Because cement is heavy, you can't transport it as well. It's cheap and it's bulky. This company has a market cap of 300 crores, cash of 100, debt of 30. So like a enterprise value of say 230, which is producing 80 crores of cash a year. So we'll be at 3 times earnings. It's hard to lose money if you're buying something at 3 times earnings.
But I mean,
bankruptcy.
I mean, when you kind of, it's because, when you say that, one would also then think that, really, is nobody seeing that? I mean, is there something I don't know?
Yeah.
That fear is always there, right? I mean, are they cooking their books? Are they, I don't know. Is there some fraud being committed and they are too small to come on the radar? Or you are like, because you're putting the momentum filter on top of that, you are like, I'll be out by then.
No, it's a very valid concern, actually. The 2,000 companies or so, depending on how you define it, the 2,000 or 3,000 companies in India right now, only the top 150 or so are heavily owned, tracked by analysts. When you look at the Economic Times or CNBC, everybody's talking about the same 100 stocks or so. whether it's Infosys, Tata Motors, Asian Paints. There's also, as a fund, there are certain risks to owning such kind of companies. Like, for example, suppose you were to buy TCS, Tata Consultancy, and TCS does badly. People say, what is wrong with TCS? But if you buy a company like GHCI and does badly, they're like, what is wrong with you?
Yeah. And, the biggest fear for me personally is I look at a lot of these small cap, mid cap names, and personally, I'm also sure. For me, the biggest risk, Harsh, is like illiquidity. Like for me, like if, and I think that's improving over time and more and more guys get into it, but it sort of scares me so much. Like if, what if I'm just stuck holding it and I want to get out of it? That just bothers me so much that if it pops 30%, I'd like to get out of it. Like, you said, but will I be able to get out? And, there's an argument made that, that risk is already priced in into the depressed multiple and you can't lose. I get that. But for me, a real concern is, I get it, but I've paid it. I want my money back now. That scares me. And is that something that you've run into while exiting any position?
Okay, so let me tell you something interesting, that these things, these techniques work across market caps. So if I personally filter out companies less than 300 crore market cap in general, but depending, you can choose your own filter. You want like only look at companies above 1,000 crores, above 2,000, above 5,000. No matter what market cap you use, you will beat the index handsomely. You will beat all mutual funds. But the timing will not matter. Over a 10-year period, you should beat them. Your returns might be 1-2% less if you start looking at slightly bigger names, but you will still do very well if you look at bigger names.
So no, obviously Harsh is a firm proponent.
Yeah.
Now it's up to you, Sharad.
See, when you invest, actually, there are just 3-4 parameters which actually matter, or with most things in life. But people often get seduced by stories, or they will start looking at ratios and parameters which really don't matter as much.
Mm-hmm. I agree, yeah.
In fact, there's often, like, even with management, there's a halo effect around them. The reason they consider great management is because the company happens to be doing well at that time. It's not really the management is anything extraordinary.
Yeah.
No, as human beings, we love a story. Like, for example, just to give you an experiment which was conducted, they had a mock trial situation where the prosecutors presented evidence in story order, while the defense presented evidence in the witness order. First this witness, then that witness. So 78% of the jurors found a suspect guilty. When the formats were reversed, only 31% of the jurors found a suspect guilty, despite the same facts being presented in both cases.
I have a feeling you're an avid reader of like Kahneman, Tversky, or Richard Thaler. I have a feeling I could sense that. I was just waiting for you to say like heuristics or something, and then everybody's brains are going to freeze. That what are these guys talking about? Harsh, this was very fascinating. Obviously, it's kind of we are all kind of avid market. Participants, we are avid market watchers, and it's all like the toughest thing I think when it comes to investing is to have a very high conviction rationale or framework around it and then to stick to it. So obviously during this conversation you have thrown light on a tool which personally I did not know much about. I think one subconsciously does a few of these things, but you have kind of obviously put a more step-by-step process around it, which I'm sure a lot of the listeners are going to benefit from. So thanks a lot, Harsh. This was a fairly fascinating chat.
It was fun. And
just to add to a few more things, actually, quantitative methods are often considered to be a black box, an opaque, secretive process that works only in theory but fails in the real world, and often they're shunned by the investment community. And quants have often earned this negative reputation also. They've kept things so impenetrable, hard to understand. While I believe communication should be as simple and transparent as possible. Now, people often make the proprietary strategies unnecessarily complex out of fear of being replicated by others. And this behavior is completely rational, for certain high-speed arms race kind of strategies that aren't scalable to large sums of money. But, however, with regards to persistent, sustainable strategies, this lack of opacity, clarity, leads to investor failure. Because at certain pinnacle point of pain, when the most disciplined, hardened investors earn their keep, the active investor with a clear mind and a strong process will win. Those who don't fail to, understand why you're using these processes, they're the ones, who will face like a grim outcome.
Yeah, no, that's I couldn't agree more. And yeah, it's you know, something that we are going to do lifelong and be disciplined about it. And it comes down to that, I guess. It was a thoroughly exciting chat, Harsh. Thanks so much for your time. And we're going to keep an eye on your, obviously, platform.
You're going to keep an eye on Celan Exploration for sure. Since that was the first thing that came in on your mind when you when it came to talking about deeply discounted opportunities.
The company is selling less than cash. There's more cash than the market cap.
Yeah, I mean,
I keep on thinking of ITC also on the other end. Anyways, I mean, I don't know. We'll go into circles, you know, talking about this all day. But no, thanks a lot, Harsh. And yeah, I think this was good. And with that, I think we can end this exciting podcast. What do you think? Today I put exciting in the end, not in the beginning. Sharad, what do you think?
Yeah. No, I agree. This was fun chat, and I'm gonna jump to running some of the screens right after this chat.
There'll be some aftermarket orders tonight after this podcast. So yeah, there you go. No, this was fun. So this is Nikhil Arora.
This is Sharad Tupran
signing off.